All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Mary J. Schoen presiding. All who have business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. My name is Judge Schoen. To my right is Judge Peach. To my left is Judge Greenberg. We're here today to hear the case of Charles William versus David J. Shulkin, M.D., Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 163252. Would counsel for each party please state your appearance for the record?
Good morning. My name is Megan Gentile with the Veterans Legal Advocacy Group, representing the appellant Charles Williams. To my side is Harold Hoffman, also of the Veterans Legal Advocacy Group, representing the appellant Charles Williams.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Alex Hugh on behalf of the Secretary. With me is Joe Moriarty, also with the Secretary.
Thank you. Does appellant counsel wish to reserve any time for?
Yes, please, Your Honor. 10 minutes.
Be done.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Megan Gentile of the Veterans Legal Advocacy Group. To my side is Harold Hoffman for the appellants. There's a legal question before the court today, and that is, what is a penile deformity under Diagnostic Code 7522? The appellants have made the legal argument that the penile deformity under 7522 contemplates nerve damage. The Secretary has been making a factual argument that under the facts, the veteran doesn't have a nerve deformity. But the Secretary hasn't provided a legal argument pertaining to what is the definition of a penile deformity under 7522. So that leads us to the first question the court has directed us to, which is, what is required for a showing of deformity under Diagnostic Code 7522? So the Secretary has provided some guidance in the M21 telling us that deformity must be evident. But neither the word evident nor the word deformity have been expressly defined by the Secretary. Now, in the absence of such an express definition, we have to go to the ordinary meaning of these types of terms. Now, deformity, first. Under Collins Dictionary, it's a part of someone's body which is not the normal shape, or a physical blemish or a distortion. Maybe the most instructive is Dorland's Dictionary. That would be Dorland's Medical Dictionary. A distortion of any part or general disfigurement of the body. Now, Dorland's actually goes in and provides both internal and external deformities. An external deformity, an example that it provides is a deformity of the thumb. An internal deformity that Dorland's gives as an example for its definition of deformity is ureteroceles, which is a deformity of the tube that runs between the kidney and the bladder. This is not an external deformity that can be seen by the type of examinations that, for example, Mr. Williams, our appellant, underwent when he was examined by various VA examiners. Now, VA hasn't defined evident either when we're talking about what is the meaning of evident deformity. Evident, once again, the ordinary meaning of that term would be clear to the vision or understanding. So this leads us to the conclusion that an evident deformity must be clear to understand that that there is a distortion of any part or a general disfigurement of the body. Well, this leads us to the second question that the court's directed us to address. Does the nerve damage incurred during a prostatectomy qualify as a deformity under Diagnostic Code 7522? Now, as the court is aware, the veteran's cavernous nerve was severed as a result of his prostatectomy several years ago, and that severed cavernous nerve remains in that severed state today. It is obvious, it is evident, it is clear to the understanding from the veteran's records and from the records presented from VA to us at the court that the veteran's nerve damage took place. It's undisputed. It's still there. The veteran has a severed cavernous nerve. So nerve damage incurred during a prostatectomy qualifies as a deformity under Diagnostic Code 7522 because nerve damage is an evident deformity. It's for these reasons that we, the appellants, argue that the veteran's nerve damage, his severed cavernous nerve, qualifies directly under Diagnostic Code 7522.
Well, You mentioned this condition, this internal condition in Dorland's, which may be relevant, but what about something more directly related to this condition, such as Peyronie's disease?
Yes.
You familiar with that?
Yes. I mean,
why wouldn't you argue that? I mean, that's a well-recognized condition, internal.
Yes, Your Honor. The veteran's particular condition is very similar to Peyronie's disease, in fact. Peyronie's disease involves plaques that build up inside one of the bodies of the penis that prevent blood flow from blood from actually flowing to the penis and preventing someone from achieving an erection. The veteran has a very similar condition whereby a change in the veteran's body, a physical change in the veteran's body, has prevented him blood flow from entering his penis such that he can obtain an erection.
Would Peyronie's disease qualify as an evident deformity?
Yes, Your Honor, it would.
Under D.C. 7522?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Evident physically or externally or internally, Peyronie's disease?
That would be both, Your Honor, because the Peyronie's disease is manifested by these plaques, which are internal, but it's also manifested by the fact that an erection cannot be achieved due to these plaques. So there is a link between the veteran's physical attribute, which is his internal deformity, leading him to an external attribute, which is his inability to achieve that.
No, what I meant is in Peyronie's disease, if a medical examiner would just take a physical examination, would it be evident that there's a deformity?
When you say physical examination,
you're looking at it.
Okay, I'm assuming you mean of the type that, like in an exam.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Not imaging.
No imaging, physics, okay. Right. With the eyes.
There are some instances where Peyronie's disease can be visible to the naked eye without any imaging done, and there are some instances where it can't, but that doesn't make it more or less mm-hmm. Peyronie's disease. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the plaques can result in something that is very obvious to the naked eye, and sometimes they do not result in that type of a circumstance.
If I can clarify something that you said, and I think it may also tie into one of your arguments in your brief, that you were arguing that the appellant's inability to have sexual intercourse and maintain an erection was a deformity itself?
Yes, Your Honor. We argue that the veteran's deformity has both external and internal attributes. Now, we know that the veteran's internal attributes are less visible to the naked eye, say, in his various examinations that he had. But due to the fact that the veteran has a permanently flaccid penis that will never become erect as a result of his deformity, he has both external attributes to his deformity as well as...
Wouldn't that just be redundant to the diagnostic codes already calling for ED?
Well, Your Honor, the veteran's type of erectile dysfunction is permanent and total, and it cannot possibly be changed.
I don't see a qualifying or more limited requirement for the ED in the diagnostic code.
Yes, Your Honor. That is why we believe that the internal deformity, which consists of Mr. Williams' severed cavernous nerve, is the more powerful argument as to what qualifies as a deformity under Diagnostic Code 7520.
But isn't it what you're really after, this special monthly compensation, is far less than compensation under the other side of the mix?
Yes, Your Honor. There is special monthly compensation associated with the veteran's erectile dysfunction.
Right.
I do believe that is less.
It's substantially less,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes, than it would be with the for a compensable rating.
Right. Isn't that why you're here?
Yes, Your Honor.
So just to go on that line of questioning, if the appellant who is now receives special monthly compensation for loss of the creative organ, I take it that's what it is?
Yes, Your Honor.
If your client or your appellant was successful at the 20%, would the special monthly compensation drop out, or are they together? I mean, can you get both?
Yes. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's something I actually will want to discuss with the secretary, because it seemed like the board did not agree with your assertion.
Yes, as far as the pyramiding argument?
Yes.
Yes, we do not believe that pyramiding in any way precludes the receipt of, the pyramiding rule, we do not believe precludes the receipt of special monthly compensation.
And what is your basis for that assertion?
Can you give me, sorry, one second.
Okay.
I'll just look at it in our brief. Well, I didn't tab it in the brief, but we don't believe that pyramiding precludes it because the special monthly compensation is not in place of a compensable rating under Diagnostic Code 7522.
Do you have any language or legislative history or anything that supports that position?
Do you remember that?
I know there's a note in the diagnostic code that refers to the special monthly comp provisions.
Yes.
And it's not clear to me exactly what that referral entails. Does that mean it's in lieu of, or does it mean, I mean, it doesn't say you'd get one and not the other, and it doesn't say you get both.
Right.
Please go ahead.
Well, it is our position that these are not mutually exclusive entitlements.
Is that based on the plain language? Is that
it is based on the plain language and a lack of guidance of it otherwise as to what how pyramiding would play into these types of compensation in these situations.
What do you have to say about 7522 has a note that Peyronie's disease is not a rateable condition? Is that arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable as applied here?
Under 7522's restriction of Peyronie's disease as a rateable condition, we although it's not the veteran's particular literal condition, we do believe that not rating Peyronie's disease, which would qualify as both erectile dysfunction and a deformity, we don't understand why that's a special carve-out, and we haven't found any reason from the Secretary. We haven't found any guidance from the Secretary as to why that is the case. We nevertheless believe that there is an analogous reason why conditions like Peyronie's disease and conditions like the severed cavernous nerve would qualify for a compensable rating under 7522, which means that even if the court were not to agree that Diagnostic Code 7522 contemplates a compensable rating for an internal nerve damage, that it should by analogy. Now, we're guided by 38 CFR 4.20 and several other relevant cases and other statutes. The principles of 38 CFR 4.20 guide us towards the anatomical localization, symptomatology, and functions affected when we're looking at whether a diagnostic code is appropriate to be applied by analogy to a particular veteran's condition. Now, we already know that the veteran has one half of the verbiage listed in 7522. The veteran has loss of erectile power. We know that. Now, the veteran also has a physical attribute that that is not as, it's not what it used to be. The veteran's physical attribute is distorted, which is to say the veteran has a severed cavernous nerve plus loss of use of erectile power. For this reason, the veteran's severed cavernous nerve is analogous to the term deformity as expressed under Diagnostic Code 7522. For that reason, Diagnostic Code 7522 is not only the appropriate choice of diagnostic code, but a compensable rating under 7522 is the appropriate rating under that code.
I believe you also asserted that the board erred for not appropriately considering an extra scheduler rating. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, we did. And the reason is that extra scheduler ratings apply when the particular severity of a condition isn't contemplated by the ratings expressed in a code. Now, 7522 only has a 20% rating. Now, of course, with 4.31, there's also a 0% rating contemplated any time that a 0% rating isn't specifically expressed in a diagnostic code. That leaves us with a choice between 0% and 20%. Now, the veteran has complete and total erectile dysfunction. It's been described as severe in his December 2015 examination. it cannot be helped by various approaches and medications that the veteran has attempted. Now, this means that because 7522 only contemplates one compensable rating, it means that a person who has erectile dysfunction, intermittent erectile dysfunction with some kind of a penile, something that qualifies as a penile deformity that can be treated with pills, that can be treated with other types of therapies, would achieve a compensable rating under this code, whereas a veteran's much more severe erectile dysfunction, also accompanied by a physical attribute, would not be rateable at all.
If I may interject, I understand where you're going with that, but how does Mr. Williams satisfy step two of THUN? What other factors or marked interference with employment or hospitalization is he asserting he or has asserted he met?
Well, the veteran has asserted that his personal relationships have been extremely strained and that there's a mental strain on him as a result of his complete and total erectile dysfunction and essentially the fact that he can't have sex anymore. The veteran has no, as a result of his severed cavernous nerve and his erectile dysfunction, he has absolutely no sex life. Now, to relate these things to the veteran's employment, this would take more than a couple steps. The veteran has, however, been personally affected greatly by this. His hearing was devastating to listen to.
Do you concede that it has to affect employment for him to qualify for extra scheduler?
No, Your Honor, we don't, although we are aware of the supplemental authorities that the Secretary...
Well, that has to do with the scheduler criteria.
Right, right. Wherever practicable, as directed by the statutes, ratings should be accorded to the effects of employment. It's not always practicable. I mean, the veteran's ability to achieve an erection is indirectly related to his quality of life generally, which is, of course, related to his employment. However, it's not always directly practicable to make these ratings, and in such cases, we have to consider all of the other factors that tie into the fact that the veteran no longer has the ability to achieve erections and has...
So you're saying that if he did get the 20%, it should still be referred as extra scheduler?
Well, we believe, Your Honor, that as an analogous rating under 7522, it would not require an extra scheduler analysis to apply a compensable rating under this particular code. But an extra scheduler rating would also be another approach towards a compensable rating in the same situation and for the same reasons that the veteran suffers a great loss due to his inability to achieve erections. So today, overall, we urge the court to hold that under Diagnostic Code 7522, internal deformities qualify as deformities. We also urge the court to find that the veteran's particular internal deformity, his severed cavernous nerve, qualifies as a deformity contemplated under Diagnostic Code 7522. In such a case, no further finding of fact would be necessary to establish that the veteran is entitled to a compensable rating under Diagnostic Code 7522. Now, if the court were not to agree that a direct rating under 7522 for the veteran's cavernous nerve is appropriate, we also urge the court to consider the fact that the veteran's severed cavernous nerve is appropriately analogous under under Rule 4.20 as an analogous condition to the deformity referenced in Diagnostic Code 7522. And in such a case, warrants a compensable rating with, in addition, the considerations of extra scheduler ratings. We will yield the rest of our time for this part unless there are additional questions from the court.
Thank you. Mr. Yu. I think you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Alex Yu on behalf of the Secretary. And with me today at Council's table is Joe Moriarty, Deputy Chief Counsel for the Department of Veterans Affairs. The court should affirm the board decision now on appeal for two reasons. First, the board had a plausible basis for denying a compensable rating for erectile dysfunction for lack of evidence of a penile deformity. And second, while appellant did not address this argument, the board was permitted to decide appellant's case within 90 days after mailing of notice. First, to address the concerns from Judge Scholin, early asked to appellant as to the anti-pyramiding issue under Section 4.14. The Secretary concedes that to the extent the board said that the veteran was would not be entitled to SMC under paragraph K for loss of use of a creative organ, and at the same time entitled to a theoretical compensable rating under DC 7522, the board did err. A veteran can receive SMC under paragraph K for loss of use as well as a compensable rating under the diagnostic code.
Thank you.
But to turn to the court's first question issued on this case, what constitutes a penile deformity is a medical question. When the court remanded appellant's case in January 2015, the court recognized that medical opinion was necessary to determine whether or not the veteran had a penile deformity, whether it be internal or external. VA obtained this medical opinion in December 2015, where the examiner found the veteran had, and I quote, that there is no evidence of a penile or the deformity of the penis at all. And this,
yeah, but if I may, did that examiner actually conduct any tests?
The examiner's, this was only a medical
opinion. I thought it was the medical examiner concluded that there were no tests available to determine internal deformity.
Correct, Your Honor.
That's not what the remand required, was it? Remand said, do the test. The medical examiner said there wasn't a test. I think we've heard about Dorland's and so forth. If you just go online, you'll see that ultrasound, among others, is available. Is it not? In other words, this goes to the questions of whether there was an adequate reasons or basis for the conclusion that ultimately came back here.
Yes, Your Honor.
So is your position that what you just stated was an adequate statement of reasons and bases contemplated by the court when it remanded it to the Secretary?
First, I would like to clarify, when you say there's an adequate statement of reasons or bases, are you referring to the board's statement for accepting the VA medical opinion, or that the examiner provided an adequate statement of reasons?
Either one, but the board's decision is the one we're focused on.
Right. To the extent that the examiner indicated that there was no testing for determining internal deformity of the penis, we would have to rely on the medical evidence.
Fine, but that was adopted by the board.
Correct. We would still say that we would note that the appellant has not contested the adequacy of the December 2015 VA examination.
Does that stop us from questioning it?
No, Your Honor. But we would note that that appellant accepts that December 2015 VA examination was adequate.
By the way, I guess we'll come back to it, but this 90-day issue, has that been abandoned by the appellant? Or
no.
We haven't discussed that. All right. Just want to, while we're on the subject of what they did or didn't argue, I get your point.
Yeah. The December 2015 VA examiner was actually specifically asked whether or not, and this addresses the second question issued by the court, whether or not the nerve damage resulting from the prostate surgery constituted an internal deformity of the penis, and the VA examiner found that it did not. The examiner specifically delineated between the fact that nerve damage causes loss of erectile power, it does not constitute a deformity, and the appellant has not presented any medical evidence to the contrary to rebut the December 2015 VA examiner's negative opinion, and based on the only medical evidence of record, the board had a plausible basis to deny a compensable rating for erectile dysfunction.
If I understand, Mr. Williams is already being rated under this diagnostic code by analogy. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
So there's already a recognition of he doesn't meet all the criteria of that. He doesn't have whatever the diagnosis is that would call for that diagnostic code to apply. So, like, he doesn't have avoiding dysfunction or whatever 7522 is called. So under Stankovich and other cases like that, and he doesn't need to show that he matches every single criteria of the diagnostic code. The board needed to look at the functions and these other criteria that Lindemann sets out. Did the board do that?
While the board did not specifically outline the three factors outlined in Lindemann, DC 7522 is the best and only appropriate diagnostic code for rating erectile dysfunction by
analogy. Right, but we all recognize that we're rating by analogy, so therefore he's not going to have every single thing necessarily in that diagnostic code, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So it's setting up the veteran for failure to rate him under something and then criticizing him for not meeting every single criteria under there, and Lindemann said, no, we're going to look at these three factors in order to determine what we're going to do. So how could the board stop its analysis with just saying he doesn't meet the plain black letter of the diagnostic code by saying he doesn't have a deformity, period? Like, let's say we accept that. Then didn't they have to do more?
I would provide two responses to your question. First, under Section 4.20, which is the governing regulation for analogous ratings, conjectural analogies are prohibited, which this court in Vogan explained, VA is not allowed to create a diagnostic code for the purposes of determining, for rating an unlisted disability. So VA is required under 4.20 to find a disability rating that already exists in the schedule of ratings to rate by analogy unlisted disabilities. So in this case...
Then how do you reconcile that with Lindemann? That says you have to then go on and look at these three things.
In Lindemann, the court identified those three factors for determining the appropriate analogous rating. We would disagree that under Lindemann, that the veteran does not have to meet the requirements under the disability, under the analogous diagnostic code. Additionally, the Secretary would note that on July 28, 2017, the Secretary did propose a rule to revise DC 7522.
Has that been adopted?
That has not been adopted.
Is it relevant to this argument?
It's only relevant to the extent that we highlight this proposed rule for the purposes of explaining that the Secretary recognizes there is a conflict in that rating by analogy under DC 7522 is not perfect and is taking steps to try to amend and revise 7522 to make a better situation for rating.
Right, but that's the diagnostic code we're stuck with for this purpose. Right?
Correct. Because we are left with an imperfect diagnostic code, this appellant is stuck with having to meet the requirements under DC 7522 for a compensable rating.
How does anybody ever meet the criteria if we apply your interpretation of the application of an analogous rating? How does anybody ever satisfy the criteria? Because if they could actually satisfy the criteria, they probably would have had the disease that the diagnostic code is called.
Yes, Your Honor. We'll distinguish between cases such as this one where DC 7522 has two black and white requirements. You either have loss of erectile power or you don't. You either have penile deformity or you don't. There are other rating codes within the existing, other diagnostic codes within the schedule of ratings that have more subjective requirements. And when there are more subjective requirements, then analogous ratings do not run into the same problem we do.
So only veterans who are fortunate enough to have a condition that is analogous to a squishy diagnostic code can be compensated for the diseases or the symptoms they actually have.
Again, the Secretary has recognized that that DC 7522 is not perfect.
So it's instead chosen not to provide any compensation.
As highlighted in the Federal Register, there's a recognition that erectile dysfunction with or without penile deformity is not associated with decrease in earning capacity.
So that doesn't really have to do with the adequacy of how it's described or compensated. It has to do with whether it actually goes to employment impact.
Yes, Your Honor. The purpose of the schedule of ratings is to compensate veterans for disabilities that impact their earning capacity, and therefore the it's VA's long-held policy that erectile dysfunction does not impact right massive. But there is a recognition that under SMC, under paragraph K, a veteran is compensated for loss of use of a creative organ, which does not require an impact on earning capacity.
I don't get it. What's the basis for the Secretary's distinction in terms of employability between these two?
The schedule rating.
Inability to procreate and erectile dysfunction, two different things, one of which has an impact on employability and the other doesn't?
No, Your Honor. What I meant was the schedule of ratings, all diagnostic codes under the schedule of ratings, their purpose is to compensate for disabilities that impact earning capacity, whereas SMC is separate,
right,
and does not require or is not meant to compensate for loss in earning capacity. Therefore, for disabilities such as erectile dysfunction, veteran is entitled to a 0% rating because it doesn't impact earning capacity, while SMC recognizes that there is an impact on the veteran that is separate from impacting earning capacity.
And this is a determination that the Secretary has made in good faith in accordance with the Administrative Procedure Act, and on what medical basis, if I may ask? In other words, the Secretary has said that erectile dysfunction has no impact. It's a zero rating.
Correct.
With regard to employability. That's the essential ingredient in all of these compensation claims, isn't it?
Correct, Your Honor.
So how did the Secretary arrive at that?
I can't identify for you the specific basis for it. However, it is the long-held policy of VA that erectile dysfunction by itself does not.
So if, let's get back to basics for a moment. Is this court without the power to say that what the Secretary is arguing doesn't make any sense and is therefore arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable? Surely we have that capacity.
The court could. The Secretary.
Why shouldn't we here say that? Doesn't make any sense.
Well, first we would note that there's no allegation that appellant's erectile dysfunction does impact earning capacity. In fact, appellant, as part of her arguments, actually specifically stated that that's not the case here. However, we would still note that there's no basis, there's no evidence of the record that appellant's earning capacity has been diminished by his erectile dysfunction.
Since you mentioned the 90-day letter, in this case, I believe the 90-day letter said that they could decide the case within 90 days, or the veteran had 90 days to submit evidence, or until the board made a decision.
Correct, Your Honor.
One of your colleagues in Clark, which was a case that I was participated in oral argument in recently, your colleague argued that, or conceded that, when a case was remanded from this court, the board, the letter the board sent was erroneous in saying that they had 90 days or until the board made its decision. Instead, it should have been a straight Kaczorowski, you get a full 90 days.
Correct, Your Honor. I would first highlight the language specifically in Section Bill 20.1304 and the notice letter sent out on May 9, 2016 says the veteran has 90 days from the date of the letter or until the board issues a decision, whichever comes first.
Right. I'm familiar with that language. Right. But I'm just saying in Clark, your colleague said when the board said that in the letter, that was erroneous. The board could not have made its decision within the 90 days. But for your colleague asserted there was a waiver on the part of the veteran, and instead that they were entitled to a full 90 days under Kaczorowski.
Correct, Your Honor.
Not 90 days or, just 90 days.
Right.
So I'm trying to reconcile what is the position of the department in that this case had been remanded by the court at some point. So why do you have a different position than your colleague does?
The Secretary's argument is that we would distinguish between the cases addressed in Clark and in Kucherowski, where the case was remanded directly from the courts to the board, with this case at bar, where the case was actually returned from the AOJ to the board following at least one prior board remand. We identified that this distinction is the reason why in Clark we acknowledge, the Secretary acknowledges that in cases directly remanded from the courts of the board, there's a full 90 days because when in those situations, the record is reopened anew, and the 90-day period is the only opportunity the veteran has for developing evidence of record or responding to the evidence of record. We would contrast the cases such as this one, where appellant is actually granted two opportunities to respond to the evidence of record. So under Section 19.38, cases that are returned from the AOJ to the board, after the SSOC is issued, appellant is granted 30 days to respond to the evidence of record.
But in this case, the letter said he had 90 days. Is that correct?
Correct.
So he really only had 30?
No,
because you said the notice is required to give him 30 days.
Let me clarify.
Please.
So
I'm confused.
The Secretary's argument here is that the veteran was granted two distinct opportunities to respond to the evidence of record. There was first the 30-day period following the December 2015 SSOC, after which the case is returned from the AOJ to the board. The May 9, 2016 notice letter actually initiated a second period in which the veteran could have responded to the evidence of record. We would note that in this case, on March 28, 2016, appellant did actually respond through his current counsel, did respond to the evidence of record by submitting arguments directly to the board. Because appellant is granted these two separate opportunities to respond to the evidence of record, our argument is that.
So, what authority is there for the second period under your construct? You said Section 19.38 gives you 30 days following the SSOC.
Correct.
What gives you the second period started by the May letter?
The Secretary would first argue that the Section 20.1304, Section 20.1304, the plain language states that a veteran has 90 days or until the board issues a decision on their case, whichever comes first. So we would argue that under the plain language of both the regulation cited in the May 9, 2016 notice letter and the notice letter itself, establishes that the veteran would not necessarily have the full 90 days.
So the authority for VA sending the May letter and asserting that he had 90 days or until the board decided was 20.1304?
Correct, Your Honor.
So under 20.1304, it says that the notice letter goes out after the case is certified to the board. Yes.
Correct.
So is it your position that certification is not only the initial transfer from the regional office time to the board, but occurs any subsequent time a case returns to the board?
No, Your Honor. The Secretary's position is that under we would first argue that Section 20.1304 doesn't apply in this case.
Does not.
Does not. But to the extent that the May 9, 2016 notice letter raises the applicability of Section 20.1304, we would argue that the board was still permitted to decide his case within 90 days of the notice letter.
I'm sorry, I'm thoroughly confused now.
Yeah,
you told me the authority for the board to send the May 2016 letter was 20.1304, but you said 20.1304 doesn't actually apply. So the board didn't really have authority under 20.1304 to send that letter. So sending that letter was a mistake?
We would say that the board was not required to send the May 9, 2016 notice letter under 20.1304.
What was the board required to do?
In this case, we would say that after the notice letter, or after appellant's case had been returned to the board, after the 30-day period under 19.38, the case would have been ripe for re-adjudication.
So do you think that there's any sort of problem in the board telling the veteran he has any time at all, irrespective of whether you think the board had the authority to decide the case on date two that it got there, in telling the veteran that he's going to have some time when he actually didn't have any time at all under the law?
We would say that under the notice letter that was sent out, appellant became aware that he didn't necessarily have the full 90 days.
Right, but what you're saying is he didn't have any days at all. It was just happenstance that the board didn't get to it for 43 days or whatever it was.
Correct.
So you don't think that there's any problem in misleading the veteran into thinking that they may have some time to submit information?
We would disagree that the notice letter was misleading. To the extent that the appellant had some time, we would argue that the notice letter and the notice letter makes clear that that time is could be less than 90 days. We would also note that because the appellant has already been granted that first initial 30 days, and in this case, nearly 6 months elapsed between the date the SSOC was issued and the board actually deciding the claim, the appellant had multiple opportunities to respond to all the evidence of record that had been developed since the prior board remand and the remand by this court, which appellant did take the opportunity to do so on March 28, 2016. I hope I've answered Judge Schulman's
question. You have. It's just kind of, I would think in an agency that says it's being helpful to the veteran that you might want to consider how helpful it really is to tell somebody you have 90 days when you have, in theory, no days.
And by the way, why didn't you just say you have 90 days, but you're taking your chance, Mr. Veteran, that we can decide it tomorrow and then you don't have any time?
Well, I think they are, because they say, or until the board decides.
Yeah, I know, but if I were a veteran and not a lawyer and not an official of the department, I might very easily say I've got 90 days. And I'm going to take the full 90 days. Wouldn't that be a reasonable expectation for the veteran receiving that letter? Because you don't really say, look, in a colloquial way, in a average reasonable person, a veteran receiving the 90-day letter, you don't say categorically, but be careful because we may decide it in less than 90 days. Sure, you put them on notice that it might occur before the 90 days, but what do you think the average human being getting that letter would think? I got 90 days or...
How fast this whole process has gone?
Yeah.
Should I really be worried about this?
Yeah. 3 years to get a hearing, 5 years to get a case decided, 2 years to sit outside the room and get a diagnosis, and all of a sudden I've got less than 90 days at the whim of the secretary or this board to decide? You think it's right? Do you think it's fair? Do you think the reasonable person receiving that letter would assume that he better hurry up because he's buying a lottery ticket for 90 days or something less?
The Secretary, we would provide two responses. First, we would, again, the Secretary's position is that the notice letter does put the veteran on notice that he could have less than 90 days to respond to the evidence record. Additionally, by not holding the record open for a full 90 days, because the appellant has already been granted an opportunity to respond to the evidence record, the board complies with the court or with VA's requirement to provide expeditious treatment to cases responded or remanded by the courts from the court. If VA were required to hold open the case for the full 90 days, even though appellant has already been granted an opportunity to respond to the evidence of record, they would then run afoul of the requirements to provide expeditious.
Well, what's the purpose of the 90 days? This is created by the secretary. The statute doesn't require it. Isn't this a veteran-friendly, theoretically,
correct
regulation?
Correct.
So on the one hand, you do something for the veteran, and same hand might take it away.
Again, we would note that because it is generally in the interest of the veteran to have a decision earlier rather than have to wait, by not requiring the board to hold open, or by the board not holding open the case for the full 90 days, that's the only way it could provide expeditious treatment.
Does the letter say anything about if you'd like us to decide it sooner, please tell us? I'm sorry, I don't recall exactly what it says.
I do not believe the letter specifically states that you can waive that you can waive the additional time. However, in the initial, when the SSOC was sent out, it does note you have 30 days to respond. But if you would like to have us decide the case or send the case to the board earlier, you can respond and tell us to do so.
How much of an administrative burden would it be on the secretary to send a letter to the veteran saying, we're ready to go here after 1 day, 5 days, 10 days, 40 days, whatever. We're ready to go. But you remember that 90-day letter you got. We're ready to decide it. Do you have anything to tell us? Otherwise, we're going to not give you the full 90 days.
The secretary would say that the notice letter sent out on May 9, 2016 effectively does that.
It's I understand your argument. Right. But what if we were to disagree? And what would be the administrative fair for us to consider, what, if any, administrative burden would there be on the secretary or the board who says, we're ready to rule. You got your 90 days. We're serious. It's coming out. Do you have anything more to send in, or do you want to take the full 90 days? Is that a big burden? You know where the veteran is.
Right. I'm not prepared to say to what extent the burden would be on the secretary to do so. However, we note there are a significant backlog for cases that need to be decided, and four cases remanded from the court. VA is directed to provide expeditious treatment to require a second letter that we see as effectively functioning as the first notice letter. This would only exacerbate the wait time for veterans.
And that's the irony of if somebody is coming back from the court with expeditious treatment, they get a full 90 days, but if they're on their way back up, then they get less than that in order to be expeditious. So I appreciate you're in a difficult position. You're trying to defend what the regulation says. I think we're questioning more the wisdom of the regulation. Not your argument.
Right. To address that particular type of situation where, as acknowledged by the Secretary and Clark, and under Kucherowski, there's a full 90-day period to respond to the evidence of record. For example, in this case, nearly 6 months elapsed between when all the evidence of record had been developed and when the board actually issued its decision. So we would again note that
the 90 days is irrelevant to this determination?
No, Your Honor. It's just simply to note that while in other cases under Kucherowski, veteran would be guaranteed 90 days, while there's only a carve-out for 30 days in cases such as this one, in effect, the veteran here actually got 6 months to respond to the evidence of record.
I'd like to kind of get back to the deformity issue, if I might.
Yes.
What we have here is the veteran had a prostate operation.
Correct.
The operation resulted in nerve damage.
Correct, Your Honor.
The nerve damage resulted in ED.
Correct, Your Honor.
The nerve is internal.
Correct.
The VA, the Secretary has conceded that a deformity can be internal. Or did I misstate something there?
No, you're correct. In okay. the
And so the question we have is nerve damage considered a deformity? Yes.
Correct.
And you started your argument with saying that a deformity was medical determination.
Correct.
Now, can you kind of talk about what the medical examination, since there was alluded to the fact that perhaps the remand was for a medical examiner to see if there was nerve damage and that there are tests to determine nerve damage, sonogram, somebody said. So far, so good?
Correct.
Okay. So what would the doctor do? What would the medical examiner do? The VA has already said he's got nerve damage.
Correct.
So what is it that the medical doctor or the examiner would do, since you said this was a medical question? Maybe we could talk about at least some way this would change the perspective of this case into...
Yes, Your Honor. I see my time has nearly elapsed.
You could add 3 minutes to his time, please.
In this case, the VA examiner actually identified nerve damage and said that nerve damage doesn't cause deformity. It causes loss of erectile power. So we would note first that while there was no specific testing for internal deformities, the examiner was able to determine, based on the evidence that already existed in the record, in his medical opinion, that nerve damage is not the type of internal issue that would result in a deformity.
So the Secretary's position is that nerve damage, while internal, is not a deformity.
Correct. And the medical evidence here makes that clear. And we would also note that there's no contrary medical evidence to rebut the examiner's opinion.
But did the physician say, or did the medical examiner say that?
Yes. The examiner's exact words were, nerve damage does not cause deformities generally, but rather loss of function. So while I wouldn't be able to articulate exactly what the examiner would need to do to determine what internal deformity would be, we would note that in this specific case, the nerve damage is not a deformity, as established by the medical evidence.
I know you're not a physician, and nor am I, but could a nerve not having been severed, but maybe somehow by birth or something, can that be a deformity? Some kind of a shortcoming in the nerve constitute deformity?
The Secretary isn't prepared to answer. It would be completely speculative for me to answer that.
Thank you.
Unless there are any further questions, the Secretary asks that the court affirm the board decision that denied consular rights for erectile dysfunction.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Now I have too many papers. If it pleases the court, we're happy to address either the 90-day issue or the deformity issue first, if the court has a preference.
Whatever you think you need to respond to.
Okay. In that case, Your Honor, we'll address the deformity issue first. The issue of deformity, as I mentioned earlier, it's a legal question at the outset, and then it can turn into a medical question if it requires further medical evidence to be substantiated. Now, as I mentioned, the Secretary has not defined the term deformity. It seeks to define, maybe talk about what it isn't in this case, but certainly has discussed what it is. Now, the medical examination that the Secretary relied upon didn't answer the question of whether nerve damage constitutes deformity, nor is it competent to. A medical examiner doesn't write regulations for the VA. The medical examiner discussed whether nerve damage causes deformity. And the medical examiner also stated that he did not do any kind of an internal investigation to determine whether the veteran's nerve damage can be seen. So in that respect, we're still in a situation, despite the Secretary's defenses, where we're putting the cart in front of the horse. The horse being the legal definition of deformity, and the cart being how it might apply to the veteran's particular medical situation. Moving on to the 90-day issue. Now, in this situation, the veteran's issue on appeal has been to this court already. That was brought, I believe, in 2012 and briefed in 2014. Now, it was remanded by the court and is back at the court again. Now, the veteran received his 90-day letter, and we were representing the veteran at the time. We did submit some additional evidence, but we had not, and we requested this, but we had not even received the veteran's December 2015 VA exam. Now, the Secretary has defended that the veteran had multiple opportunities to respond during the SSOC process and whatnot. The veteran received his supplemental statement of the case. We responded to that SSOC, but we still didn't even have the evidence we needed in order to fully respond. And then the veteran's 90 days were truncated by early board decision. The veteran was provided notice under 1304A.
I'm sorry, have you asserted that you hadn't received a copy of the exam?
At the time that we responded to the SSOC.
Okay, and in your pleadings before the board or anything like that, or before this court, did you assert that error?
I believe that we did.
We didn't make the argument that...
I'm sorry.
No, please. ...we sufficient time to respond to the exam. We made an SSOC response in which we requested the exam results while we waited for the exam results and then filed a response.
If you could stand so that we can get you recorded, could you say that again, please, sir?
Very sorry.
We received an SSOC. We filed a quick response and asked for the exam results. We received the exam results and then almost immediately received a 90-day letter. Before the exam was responded to, the board made a decision.
Thank you.
So, in this case, Your Honor, the veteran received a 90-day letter referencing Rule 1304A. There are two problems with that. The first one is that now the Secretary is arguing that 1304A doesn't apply, and that was some kind of an erroneous notice. It is on its face defective notice of 1304. The 90 days provided in 1304A doesn't apply, yet the veteran has been informed that it does. And second of all, we believe that there's a constitutional issue here, as we have argued in our brief. We believe that 1304A is an unlawful interpretation of the statutes that enable VA to make its regulations. It allows for capricious results, and it conflicts with the pro-veteran and pro-claimant nature of the VA's adjudication process. It's not subject to Chevron deference. It should not be given Chevron deference, in as much as it allows for arbitrary action, which is unsupported by any kind of VA policy, and unreasoned for the board to act early before the expiration of purported notice that it's saying to give. It's capricious because it allows for capricious results. The board can act at any time during this 90 days at its whim. And it's contrary to law because it gives defective notice. It purports to give notice for the veteran to provide additional evidence, obtain additional counsel, decide whether he would like a hearing or provide additional argument. But it doesn't actually give 90 days. So,
if we take the Secretary's position that 20.1304 doesn't even apply in this context, and that the board could have decided the case the moment it arrived, does that in any way alter your argument?
Well, notwithstanding the fact that we believe that 1304A is an unlawful interpretation, we believe that even if it were a lawful interpretation and the board were to cite some other rule that we were not challenging, and that rule provided notice that the veteran didn't actually have, the VA is providing defective notice, which in addition is a violation of the veteran's due process rights. Okay, we yield the rest of our time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The case will be submitted for a decision. The court is now adjourned. We will come down and greet you.